The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ARFCOM do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the stick of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCOM starts now.
That's right, Radio Free ARFCOM starts right now on a beautiful Monday evening. It's May 3rd, fellow ARFCOMers, ladies and gentlemen out there in our listening audience, and we have another great show lined up for you tonight. I am in a particularly good mood today, but that's for personal reasons. I'll keep that to myself, but things are going really well. We've got an outstanding show lined up. We actually have an RFA exclusive, just like we did a couple weeks ago with the Bushmaster guys and the Magpul talking about the ACR. I want to let everybody know who won prizes in the Bushmaster Magpul drawing that those prizes will be shipping this week. I promise you, there's been a little bit of delay, I know, but those prizes will be in the mail this week. You should have your stuff here within 10 days or so at the outside. So to those of you who have been wondering, hey, where's my prizes? I won some prizes. They're on their way, I promise. Today, our RFA exclusive is Neil Puckett. He's the attorney for Petty Officer McCabe. His trial started today. He is one of the SEALs accused of abusing a prisoner in custody. We're going to have Neil Puckett on here shortly in about, 15 minutes or so, maybe a little bit longer than that. He's going to talk about the course of action that happened today in trial, the first day of the trial. There were some motions filed, and he's going to tell us about each of those and give us an RFA exclusive on that. Also, we have our part two of our interview with Goat Boy, talking about some changes and additions to the site, stuff that he's been working on in the background and get things finished there. And in the second hour, we're going to have Mr. Henry Schwartz and Dr. Peter Pry on the show from Impact America. That is, they are a nonprofit organization, an EMP awareness organization that are trying to help the Congressional Committee on EMP get some laws passed to protect our infrastructure. And they're going to be on to talk about the specific threat EMP poses to us. And it's not this big fictional thing that you think it is. It's not some comic book 24 Jack Bauer type stuff. It is a legitimate threat. And Dr. Pry is one of the foremost experts on EMP. He's been studying it for almost 30 years now with some of the brightest minds in the Department of Defense, in the intelligence community, and on Capitol Hill. And he'll be on the show with Henry Schwartz, the founder of Impact America, to talk about those threats. As usual, we start off the show with our superstar, NRA board member Joe DeBurgolis. Joe, how are you today?
Good, John. Yourself?
I am doing great today, Joe. It's always good to hear your voice. And I heard you actually have some good news to impart upon us today.
Very good news, John. For all of ARFCOM and for the people who supported the NRA Board of Directors election, every one of our endorsed candidates successfully either was reelected or elected to the NRA Board of Directors.
That is outstanding. You hear that, ARFCOMers? We did it. All of our endorsed candidates, all the AR-15 endorsed candidates are on the board, and that is outstanding. So how does this work now? Are they instantly on the board? Is there still some X's and O's and paperwork that needs to be done? When do they actually become sitting members?
Well, they will be sworn in this upcoming annual meeting, which starts next week. That's when I get down to North Carolina. And they will be brought in, those who obviously won re-election are already sworn in. Those who came election to the board will be sworn in. And they start from that meeting, which will be the following Monday. I believe it's May 17th.
Outstanding. That makes me feel like we are making some positive change and some real impact. That is just great. The more AR-15 endorsed candidates we can get on there, the better it's going to be for all of us. That's for sure.
Very much so, John. Every single one, that, and for the most part, the entire board is very in tune with the AR platforms. We advocate, and I always try to put this through on the NRA activism thread, is that from black powder to black rifles, we advocate for them all, but we're really making a concerted effort because that's where our interest lies at AR15.com, obviously, and every one of the people we endorse has showed a penchant for the AR platform, has advocated on its use, and is really a benefactor. So we were very, very successful, and that's kudos to every single person out there who took the time to cast their ballot.
Yeah, I personally want to thank everybody, all the ARFCOMers out there who are voting members of the NRA, who endorsed or who voted for our endorsed candidates. Thank you very much. And we will see results. We keep plugging away like this, guys. We keep doing the little things we need to do as members, and we will see the results we want to see in the long run. Now, there are a couple of Second Amendment stories I want to talk about with you today, Joe, before we move on with the show. And some of these, I'm not too sure I even understand what's going on. The NRA backed the Second Amendment Enforcement Act that was introduced in Congress. Now, I don't understand the significance of this, but maybe you can explain it to me a little bit.
Sure. Basically what it was, we had two senators, Senator John McCain and John Tester, and two congressmen, Travis Childers from Mississippi and Mark Souter from Indiana, who brought forth the Second Amendment Enforcement Act, which basically is forcing our Second Amendment rights upon the District of Columbia. I know that was pretty much handled and settled with the Heller decision, but as we predicted back then and how we're predicting now with McDonald, and we should be hearing about that decision, I'm hoping in the coming this week or next, each and every tenant of the anti-gun platform is going to be subject of a lawsuit. And this is what's happening in D.C., which is a federal enclave, and that's where why we have to take these measures. The same thing's going to happen in every other place, Illinois, New York, California, once we get our decisions. Unfortunately, we have to go the legislative route to force these type of things upon the respective states or D.C. in this case.
That's good to hear that. Yeah, I was kind of confused as to how this worked with the Heller thing. I thought the Heller thing had completely, it was cut and dried, and that was it. But I guess that's not the case at all.
It sure, well, it is for a particular part. But then, as we discussed in previous shows, where it comes to the so-called assault weapons, okay, semi-automatic or rifles, it banned certain particular firearms that were not inclusive to the Heller decision, and that's why these little things have to come through. As we discussed, there was a movement about to attach voting rights to the Second Amendment or Second Amendment. Legislation to the D.C. voting rights, and that was brought down, that was withdrawn by the delegate of D.C. just for that very reason. So in response to that, those elected officials came forward with the Enhancement Act and the Enforcement Act of the Second Amendment. It's more of a political move on both sides, but it's something that keeps focus on the Second Amendment rights in our nation's capital.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Now, the other story I wanted to talk to you about, this necessarily isn't AR-15 related, but it was an interesting story to me. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision to protect hunting media. I guess there was a law passed that was an animal cruelty law, and it was just so poorly written or whatever that the hunting shows that a lot of us enjoy would be basically forced to change everything they do and almost criminalize the way they're doing it now. Is that correct?
Most certainly, John. Well, there was a very broad decision which made any type of hunting media, be it a show on TV, the American Hunter magazine, any of the sporting magazines that we all currently enjoy, would outlaw them because it would basically say hunting is cruelty to animals. And any photos, videos, or any type of media event around or surrounding hunting would be considered cruelty. So this went through the Supreme Court, and an 8-1 decision thankfully came back, but it was so broadly the law itself before, the way the decision was before the Supreme Court ruled in this decision, was that hunting as we know it, and watching the hunting shows or what have you as we know it, would have been banned. So thankfully, the NRA pushed it, along with our good friends over Safari Club International, and very successful, and having an 8-1 decision from the Supreme Court, which basically said, we can print what you like. If you never watched the show, John, a lot of times they either warn you there's going to be impact shot, or they just don't show the impact shot at all. That was the result of this pending legislation. And they usually warn the viewer, or some shows do, some shows don't, but that's what that was a reflection of this whole decision.
Okay, I understand that now, and it's good to see the U.S. Supreme Court actually issue that decision, because I personally enjoy the hunting shows, and I don't see the big deal about the kill shots. It's part of hunting, it's part of nature, it's part of effective wildlife management. The hunters are a huge part of effective wildlife management.
Most certainly are, and that's what it's all about. We go out there, we call the herds, we bring them forward, we eat. We supply a lot of the food banks with a lot of nutritious meals for the people who are not so fortunate. It's something we do. Another effect that's also a lot of times forgotten is the economic impact that the sportsmen bring to their respective states or the states they're visiting. It's measured in the billions, John. It truly is. And there's a lot of, you know, there's taxation on our firearms and on our equipment we use to fish and go off field. And that all goes into Pittman Robertson funds. Those funds are supposed to come back for conservation efforts or whatever. So the sportsmen really drive the economy. And it's amazing why we're vilified so many different ways. But we're out there, and it's a great sport, and I thoroughly enjoy it myself.
Yeah, it's funny. You hear some of the environmentalists complain all the time about hunting is cruel and hunting is mean. And I don't think they realize what would happen if there weren't hunters out there pouring these billions and billions of dollars into
the system. You're right, John. And if you go to some of the more highly populated suburban areas where they have outlaw, and they have deer populations that cause accidents. They're constantly, we got to go out there and thin their herd. It's ridiculous. It truly is. It's a natural thing. It's a part of what we do. We're hunters and gatherers. We always have been. This is what it is, and we support the economy 1,000%. So it's kind of a shame that we have to take these type of things all the way to the Supreme Court. I'm glad that the decision came out the way it did, but it's kind of foolish.
But that's what the NRA is for, to help out those kind of things. Now, lastly, once again, Mayor Bloomberg in New York City has opened his trap, and he's talking about the quote-unquote gun show loophole. And he's got together with a bunch of other mayors around the country, and they want to close the quote gun show loophole, which we all know is not a gun show loophole. It's the right of firearms owners to do private transfers, and that's a right. And for them to try to vilify it as the gun show loophole, just it makes me sick. But why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about that?
Surely, as I mentioned before, mayors against illegal guns is surpassing and supplanting the Brady campaign as the number one anti-gun, anti-freedom, anti-sportsman, anti-Second Amendment organization out there. Mayor Bloomberg funds it directly, and he basically brings like-thinking, elected officials from all levels, not just mayors. He's got ancillary organizations, state elected officials that are against guns. You've got county executives that are against guns, and various other organizations that support this. He's the number one funder. We've been very successful in exposing exactly what the mayors against illegal guns agenda is. And we've had, I think to date, John, 75 mayors who initially signed on pull back because they were sold a bill of goods.
Oh, good.
It's something we're actively engaged in. Chris Cox and company is doing a fine job exposing this. And it's something where when mayors are approached or any elected official who has signed on and are shown that a lot of these things that the mayor and his organization has given them are wrong. So they've signed off on it and moved away. But this particular bill they're pushing or laws that they're trying to pass will prohibit me as a private citizen selling you a firearm at a gun show. We will all be considered vendors. And as vendors, we would have to register with the gun show host, a promoter, 30 days prior to the event itself. Now, a lot of times, John, you don't know your schedule. I don't know mine. Sometimes we go. I know when I attend a gun show, it's usually at the last minute. I say,
right.
Hey, I'll go over there and see what's going on.
Yep.
If I sell something, fine. If I buy something, that's fine, too. But it's no one. There's basically, what that is registration. The next thing they want to do, well, currently right now, when you and I buy a firearm, we go to the NICS. It's an automatic type of thing. It's a 1-800 number. We call it in. Comes back almost instantaneously, and you're on your way. Well, Luttenberg, the senator out of New Jersey, has written in the bill that he's posing that those records will be held for 180 days. Currently, they're destroyed within 24 hours. That's the law. He wants to extend it to 180 days. So you see these type of things. They also
right.
make a, they always point back to tragedy. They point back to Columbine or Virginia Tech or what have you. And I mourn for those people who were killed in those situations by a crazed criminal. People who take arms against somebody, make a conscious decision to do what they did, are criminals and should be dealt with harshly and severely.
Yeah, we've already got laws.
You and I, John, and our listeners, follow the rules. They follow the regulations. They go forward. Go forward, and they make sure that they practice and safeguard the firearms in whatever way they so think. Well, what they want to do now is say, that's it. You got to go through. You got to be checked. You got to register. And that's just not the way it is. So this is the infamous gun show loophole that we always hear about during election time. It's kind of remarkable because Senator John McCain, who we just spoke about, is one of the sponsors, along with Senator Tester, for the Second Amendment Enforcement Act in D.C. He was one of the primary movers to close the gun show loophole. If you remember last campaign, presidential campaign, they were running ads that Senator McCain did in support of this very legislation. So it's something, you know, always remember who your allies are, because sometimes they change quite quickly.
Yeah,
and Senator McCain,
exactly.
I respect him for his service, but he's in a very highly contested primary, J.D. Hayworth in Arizona. So he seems to be coming over to us a little bit more, where during the presidential campaign he was a little bit left and center on our issue anyways.
Yeah,
but
I think he's just trying to save his campaign at this point.
Surely is. I mean, he wanted amnesty before for the illegals coming across the borders. Now he's for, you know, the bill that was signed in Arizona last week. So it's politics makes strange bedfellows. So it's one of these things where you never know where your support's going to come from. But Mayor Bloomberg, it's his organization. He funds it. He's much like the George Soros. He's funding a lot of his own campaign issues or his own personal beliefs. And so we fight it at every turn. If you go to the website, NRAILA.org, you'll find all the information you need to know about Mayors Against Illegal Guns, the Brady campaign, and all the efforts that the NRA are doing on all our behalf.
Outstanding, Joe. And as a board member, I know you are integrally involved in a lot of this stuff, and I want to thank you very much for being an AR15.com, the original AR15.com endorsed candidate, and we've got several more now on the list. So we are making some serious progress, and I want to thank you for all your work on the projects that you do. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you, John. I just want to say congratulations. I'll read off the list of our endorsed candidates before I bid you a good night. Joe Albaugh, Pete Brownell, Richard Childress, Graham Hill, Tom King, Lance Olson, and Dwight Van Horn. Congratulations to everyone. Thanks, John.
Yep, congratulations, and thanks a lot, Joe. And we'll talk to you again next week as usual. You'll headline the show. All right, and next coming up, we have Neil Puckett. He is the attorney. He's the attorney for Petty Officer McCabe, whose trial started today. He's going to have some inside information for us about the trial and some of the motions he filed. I've had a chance to actually look at some of these motions, and they're very interesting. We're going to get into some of this. Petty Officer McCabe actually has taken a polygraph and passed that. Apparently, Geraldo's name has somehow gotten involved in this case. We'll ask him about that as well. A little background on the attorney. I don't know how many of you know this, but he's actually a former Marine Corps officer. He's not just a regular, attorney, just went to law school and whatnot. This guy actually was a Marine Corps officer. And so he brings a different perspective to defending Petty Officer McCabe in this. He's actually been there. He's been on the front lines with soldiers, and he knows how it works. I think we've got him online now. Mr. Puckett, are you there?
Hi, John. Yes, I am.
Outstanding. I really want to thank you for taking some time out of a busy, busy day today to be on the show and give us an RFA exclusive, as it were, with you on the show. I'm really excited about that. Now, before we get started, Mr. Puckett, do I call you Colonel Puckett, or do I just call you Mr. Puckett, or do I call you Neil?
You can just call me Neil.
Okay. Will do. I want to thank you for your service to our country, first and foremost.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the appreciation. That's great.
And tell us a little bit about what happened today. I've read a couple of the motions that you sent me. It's very interesting to read motions dealing in a military court as opposed to a civilian court. A lot of the stuff is different. Tell us a little bit about what happened today in court.
Well, often before trials can actually be in the military, we have to iron out what evidence is going to be introduced and what evidence isn't. We got notice basically a week ago that there was an interview with Bill O'Reilly and Geraldo Rivera, and the transcript of that seemed to indicate that Geraldo was privy to some information that might have indicated that General Cleveland wanted to, quote, do the right thing, but was prevented from doing that for some reason, and he speculated it was because of someone higher up in the chain of command. Well, that means that if true, that means that there was unlawful command influence, meaning that General Cleveland wanted to dismiss the charges, but someone, his boss, told him he couldn't or something like that. We have no way of getting at that other than to raise the motion. And if the judge were to have found that we had sufficiently raised it, the government would then have had to disprove it. In other words, prove that it did not exist. However, the judge today found her finding was that it was pure speculation on Geraldo's part. And she didn't require the government to try to prove that it did not exist. So we'll really never know whether or not General Cleveland was prevented from dismissing the charge against our client, Petty Officer Matt McCabe, after the first two SEALs were acquitted.
Interesting. That's very interesting. So just from a speculation standpoint, I don't know if you can talk about this. When you say it came from above his pay grade, that's pretty high up the chain of command. That's almost you're almost talking maybe even Joint Chiefs type thing there?
Well, what Geraldo said was he speculated that it could have been as high as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He actually said that in the interview. Now, he was basing that on his experience with Lieutenant General Sanchez early in the Iraq War, who had to deal with the Abu Ghraib situation, with which I was also directly involved. And General Sanchez was fired from his position and not given a fourth star, primarily because it was felt that he had not handled the investigation vigorously enough and perhaps sought enough discipline against enough people. And so the lessons of Abu Ghraib in the military tend to have been, don't let this happen on your watch, and if it does happen on your watch, crush it whenever there's any evidence of it. So we feel like that helps explain this almost inexplicable situation where an allegation of but a punch in the gut results in the court-martial of three of the best-trained warriors in the world.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense at all. We've had various people on the show over the last couple of weeks talking about this, and people are just mind-boggled at how this has even gotten this far. Now, right. As I understand it, Petty Officer McCabe took a polygraph. I know in a civilian court, a polygraph is inadmissible. Is it different for a military court?
No, it's the exact same rule in the military court. You understand that military rules are taken directly from the federal rules of evidence from federal court, so they're almost exactly identical, with some modifications for military-specific issues. However, you're correct in stating that Petty Officer McCabe took a polygraph in the middle of March on the issue of whether or not he punched the detainee, and he passed it. This was an independent professional polygraph that we had him take, basically from a guy who's done it for like 30 years, and he said he was non-deceptive.
Wow, that's... I don't think there's any question about that. I think we all knew that, but it's great to see that he actually could... He could prove it from an independent source. So what other motions were filed today? You filed the motion to dismiss, and so the judge ruled against that?
Yes, the judge ruled against that. Not totally unexpected, but we thought we might have had a little bit of a shot at least to force the government to try to maybe put General Cleveland on the stand or Geraldo or somebody. But the other motions were relatively standard motions in terms of what evidence was going to be admitted. Nothing really surprising. The government brought a motion to prevent us from mentioning that any of the polygraphs that have been taken. By the way, Petty Officer Keith, who was also acquitted last week, also took a polygraph as to whether or not he witnessed any abuse, and he passed that polygraph twice, by the way. And the other motion was to prevent us from mentioning the fact that the other two SEALs, one of whom's going to be a witness, were in fact acquitted. So they don't, in other words, they want to hide evidence. They want to hide evidence of our client's innocence from the jury.
So, and how did the judge rule on that motion, particularly when it comes to not being able to talk about the other two SEALs?
Well, she granted both motions because the rules say that polygraphs are inadmissible, and we didn't really contest that because that's just the rule, you know.
Right.
It's great that people know it, but it's not admissible in court. And on the issue of whether or not there had been two prior acquittals, we'll see if there's a way that comes up in the trial. But on its face, it's not relevant per se, unless somebody makes it relevant by their testimony during the court-martial. So that's not really a dead issue.
Okay, yeah, I understand completely. Before we talk more about the case specifics, let's talk a little bit about procedure and process. Is this, I understand this now goes to jury selection. Is this similar to a civilian jury selection? Is it people of the military that are in this jury? Is it civilians? What is the process here as far as the military court is concerned?
It's similar and it's different. In the civilian jury, jurors are picked from the voter roll, sort of at random. Mail-outs go out, and you know most of your listeners are probably familiar with this. In the military, the interesting thing about it is the convening authority gets to pick the members. In other words, he gets to hand select who goes down to the court martial, and that's why unlawful command influence is such an evil thing and to be guarded against, and that's why there are special rules to prevent it. Now, and it's often difficult to uncover how it is he came to send these people down. We've got a list. There's eight people who we're going to start with. We're going to be asking them questions tomorrow, both collectively and individually, and we'll see who's qualified to sit and who's not. But so we're allowed to have as many challenges for cause, meaning there's some legal reason why they should not sit as a member that the judge has to decide. But at the end of all that, each party, the government and the defense, is allowed to excuse one juror and only one without giving a reason.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we go through jury selection. How long does that typically take?
Well, depending on how much time it takes to ask individual questions, usually for a special court-martial, which only requires a minimum of three jurors, not 12, a minimum of three, we can usually wrap that up in a couple of hours.
And how many, is there a maximum to that number?
No, there is no maximum under the rules for court-martial. There's just a minimum for a special court-martial, which is a misdemeanor trial, which is the kind we have. There's also a felony trial called a general court-martial, and that requires a minimum of five court-martial members.
Okay. Now, as a defense strategy, I don't know if you can talk about this, do you want more jurors, or would you prefer less?
Well, generally speaking, more is better, but here's the interesting thing and another difference between the civilian and military system, if you're interested. In the civilian system, it takes all 12 jurors to either vote to acquit or to convict. It has to be unanimous either way. In the military system, you need two-thirds to convict. So that's good and bad too. The good part about that is the defense only has to convince a third of the jury that his guy is not guilty in order to get a finding of not guilty. In other words, you don't have to win them all over. So the numbers become important here, and the math. When you're thinking back to your grade school math, when you do fractions and you think of two-thirds, people are whole numbers. You can't divide them.
Right.
So some numbers are better than others, and generally the odd numbers are better than the even numbers. The odd numbers give us a chance to convince fewer members in order to get an acquittal that basically the government hasn't proven its case.
Right, okay, I see. So now we do jury selection. You say that could be wrapped up tomorrow. You could go into opening arguments tomorrow?
Oh, I expect we'll be giving opening statements tomorrow, and I expect the government to begin, if not finish, their case.
Oh, wow, that quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So these things move right along. Okay, now let's talk a little more procedure. There's one judge, right?
Right.
And is the judge an actual federal judge, or is this a military officer?
The judge is a military officer appointed directly to be a military judge and attends training as such. They're usually board selected. They have to be qualified in some way based on their record. They don't work for any commander on the base or any military command. That's another part of that unlawful command influence thing. The Navy and Marine Corps trial judiciary is independent from any other command in the Navy or the Marine Corps.
Okay, that makes sense. I wasn't sure whether it was a civilian federal judge or if this actually was a military officer, but it sounds like it is a military officer.
Yes, a military officer. She's a Navy captain, rank of 06, or the equivalent of a colonel in the Army, Air Force, or Marine Corps, a Navy captain.
Right. Oh, wow, okay. All right, let's go back and talk a little bit about the case. We know the other two SEALs were acquitted, which does bode well. What are some of the main things that you want our listeners to know about this case that maybe they don't know right now?
Well, one thing they may not know is that we've all been able to get into evidence this thing called the Manchester document. That's something that was discovered in Manchester, England, early in the century. That is basically an Al Qaeda training manual. It gives instructions as to what members of Al Qaeda are supposed to do if they're captured. And the heart of that is to allege abuse and try to create a situation where they can prove that they've been abused. So what that leads to is self-injury. And we've also got an oral surgeon who will testify that he's looked at pictures of the lip injury on the detainee and thinks that it's maybe a bitten canker sore or an ulcer inside the mouth that was re-injured either intentionally or unintentionally, but not consistent with trauma like a punch. Of course, Matt is not accused of punching him in the face; he's accused of punching him in the stomach. But so we've got injuries that are inconsistent with his description of what happened to him. He says he was basically knocked to the ground and kicked and beaten and punched all over his body. Basically, all they can find is one bruise in his midsection, which, oh, by the way, and here's an interesting fact, the photo wasn't taken until after he had been turned over to the Iraqis, who are known to abuse their own, who they believe have also been killing. This guy is also known to have killed many, many Iraqis in his terrorism and violence. Spent 36 hours with them, and the photos were taken after he was released from the Iraqi holding. So there's no way to disprove that his injuries might not have been caused by the Iraqi police. They do it all the time. It's well known.
Okay, yeah. Now, the timeline that people don't understand is they took this guy into custody.
Right.
They brought him back to base. He was only in U.S. custody for a short time, and then the Iraqis took him
Just a few hours, just like 3 or 4 or 5 hours he was in U.S. custody.
Right, and then there was no complaints then, there's no one came out then, and then after he came back from the Iraqis, then all of a sudden there were pictures of injuries, and that's
right.
When we started getting into some of the conflicting testimony of one of the major government witnesses, and let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
There's a
petty officer whose sole job was to maintain custody control and safeguard of the detainee. There was a point in the morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning, when the officer in charge of the team came to transport basically the detainee over to the Iraqis. That's when they were turning them over to the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm.
He noticed he had blood on his shirt. Excuse me. It's been a long day. The petty officer in charge of this guy, what happened, and three times he denied knowing anything about it at all. And on the fourth time, he said, some of the SEALs came through here this morning, you know, and he was nonspecific about that. So the key point here is that the very first suspect was the guy who now is the chief witness against the SEALs, because he had sole custody and control and responsibility for the safeguarding of this guy. And so
Right. When
the officer looks at him and says, what happens? And he says, nothing, nothing, nothing. And then all of a sudden, it's like the kid who's caught with his hand in the cookie jar. He makes up the first lie available. Some SEAL guys came through here. Well, that's true. Some SEALs did come to check on him. but there's no other evidence that any of them did any of this. And so he ended up pointing his finger at one of the three who visited at the same time, who turns out to be Matt McCabe, my client.
And this is
Since that time, his story has changed approximately six times as to what happened. It's been embellished over the time, and now he claims there were several SEALs who believes at different times in the morning abused this detainee. And the story seems to have gotten better over time.
And I'm guessing that this is Master at Arms DeMartino we're talking about, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I'm guessing his version of the facts doesn't gel with the prisoner's version of the facts either.
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, if you believe what the detainee says, he says as soon as he was brought to the holding facility, the beating began and lasted for about 5 minutes, and all he heard was one American voice. Well, that escort back to the Connex box where he was being held was by Petty Officer DeMartino alone, and Petty Officer DeMartino was there alone with him, the only person with him during the time that the detainee said he was viciously abused.
Well, so it sounds like if anybody should have been charged with this, it should have been Petty Officer DeMartino, since he was the only one that was with him during the time that he was claiming the abuse, right?
I can make a very convincing argument that that's the way it should have come out, yeah.
It's mind-boggling how these things
are. Now, couple that with the notion that Matthew McCabe, whom he says he saw hit the guy, by the way, first he doesn't name him, and then he tells somebody he saw the recoil of a punch, like when you draw back your fist after you've hit someone, which morphed into I saw a punch. Couple that with the fact that Matthew McCabe has passed a polygraph. Now, even though it's not admissible, you know, people just don't pass polygraphs. They just,
right.
You know, I've taken lots of clients over the years to polygraph examiners hoping that they would pass and I could take that information to the convening authority and get them to drop the charges. They never do. They never pass them.
That's
unless they're truly not guilty.
Unless they're truly innocent, correct?
Right, right.
Yeah, it's some of the facts on this case, once you get into it, it's so mind-boggling. From your standpoint, I know you've tried a lot of these type of cases. How do you feel about this? Or you have a really good feeling about this? Because I personally, just from the outside looking in, I think it's cut and dried. I think we're just going through formalities here now.
Well, we would like to think it's cut and dried because the exact same evidence has been presented to a jury who voted 6-0 in favor of acquittal, and then the next day it was presented to just a judge, just a military judge, and he found Pastor Keith not guilty, so it's been tried twice with the same result. But, you know, you pick a different jury, and you could get a different result. So people in my business, criminal defense business, will tell you that, you know, we don't like going into courtrooms because bad things happen in criminal courtrooms. You know, your client can get convicted, and he can get sent to jail. You know, having said that, we think that we have at least as strong, if not a stronger case than was presented before. And we believe we can reach the same result. But again, you know that in the American criminal justice system, this has been proven from time to time with DNA results, sometimes juries get it wrong. And remember also that what I told you earlier in the conversation, Major General Cleveland gets to pick the members. We don't know who he picks. We don't know why he picks them. We know we get to ask them questions, but they get to give us whatever answers they want. So, you know, I don't like to ever think that the picks would be in, you know, for a conviction, you know, have tainted jurors, but it's awfully hard to discover that with the limited
right.
process that we have.
Right. Okay, so let's say the worst does happen. Let's say he is somehow convicted of this. What punishment is he looking at, and what type of appeals process does he have available, if any?
Well, there is an appeals process in the military system. It's only automatic, though, if you get a significant amount of confinement or you get a bad conduct discharge. I don't think Matt McCabe is probably looking at jail time if he were to be convicted or a bad conduct discharge or maybe even a loss in rank. As you mentioned, I've done many of these abuse cases, abuse allegation cases over the years, war crimes cases, if you will, killings on the battlefield, mercy killings, and so forth. Our clients are convicted, they often are not punished very harshly because people take into account the fact that they're in combat, they're doing their job, sometimes mistakes in judgment are made, and they kind of give them a pass. It's not like you walk up to a guy in the bar and punch him in the gut and you have really no excuse for that. You know, these guys are in a combat situation.
But having said that, I'm not confident that we're going to put on a case that is going to result in an acquittal.
Okay. I'm pretty sure this is going to come into acquittal. I just cannot see this coming out any other way at all. I just don't understand it. So do you think the entire trial would be over by the end of this week? Definitely, correct?
Definitely the end of this week, and I would say at the latest by Thursday, unless we get hung up on some procedural issue that's unforeseen right now.
Is there an inordinate amount of witnesses that are going to be called forth?
I would say 10 or 12, but, you know, those decisions are sometimes made during trial. There are about 10 or 12 witnesses who are potential witnesses. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if all of them are going to be called or not.
Okay. Now, is the discovery process the same for these military trials? You guys get access to the witness list and all the evidence that the government is going to bring against you?
Yes. It's probably the best criminal justice system there is in that regard. The prosecution is required to basically turn over all the evidence it has in an investigation, all the statements, all the you know, everything they have, photos, DNA evidence, whatever they have, has to be turned over to the defense. And that's not true in the federal system, and it's not true in most states.
Okay. Just a couple more things here before I let you go. I know you got a really busy day tomorrow, and I don't want to burn your voice out here on this radio show, but I really thank you for giving us this information. There's a lot of things here that I had no idea about. Is Petty Officer McCabe, if he gets convicted, is he looking at losing, getting a bad discharge or losing rank, or what is he looking at?
You know, that's really so hard to say because every jury looks at things differently, but I suspect the punishment would be fairly light. However, if he's convicted, it's a federal conviction. It's no different than being convicted in federal court. Now, it would be a misdemeanor conviction, but it would be a conviction that would be with him for the rest of his life, and that's what we're trying to avoid. We want to save that for him, and we also want to save his career because he wants to continue to serve as a Navy SEAL, and he wants to deploy right back to the war and go back hunting bad guys that, you know, that he's been trained to do, and this is simply delaying that from taking place. So the American people are being deprived of a heroic young warrior who took down this guy who's the mastermind behind the Fallujah Bridge incident with the Blackwater guards being killed and burned and mutilated. He's the guy who took him down, and now, you know, he's not able to be returned to the battlefield, which is where he wants to be, by the way, because of this silly process.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure he's just chomping at the bit to get back with his brothers in arms and go out, like you said, catch the bad guys. He's trained. He's sacrificed so much of his life and gone through so much just to get to the point where he can actually do that. Now they take it away from him for something that he actually should have been probably getting a commendation medal for or some type of notice for a job well done, and instead these poor guys are getting charges put on him. I just don't understand.
Well, once we get him acquitted, I'm going to be demanding that he be given the heroic decorations that he deserves for those missions he accomplished over there on that deployment.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad. That's outstanding. His name is Neil Puckett, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Marine Corps retired Neil Puckett. He's the attorney for Petty Officer McCabe, whose trial will definitely begin tomorrow, and we'll know in a few days. Mr. Puckett, when the trial's over, can we get you back on here?
Absolutely. Happy
okay.
to do it. Thanks for taking an interest in the case, and thanks to all your listeners.
Yep, absolutely. We did a fundraiser last week for all the fundraising organizations, Save Our Seals and all those. I hope we got some money raised for the Legal Defense Fund. We also had some people, Justin from Pipe Hitters, I'm sure you're aware of him. We had a few people on. I hope we were able to raise some money for you, and I look forward to having you on again, hopefully as soon as next Monday, just to give us an after-action report of the trial.
Thanks again. Just give us a call. We'll be glad to do it.
Outstanding. Thank you. That was Neil Puckett, an outstanding patriot, an outstanding citizen, former warrior, former U.S. Marine, Lieutenant Colonel, just a great guy, great interview, and it's good to know that Petty Officer McCabe is in good, competent hands with Mr. Puckett. Right now, we are moving along on the show. We have our part two of our interview with Goat Boy, talking about site additions and site changes. Some little tweaks that are coming up here shortly that you can look forward to on AR15.com. Enjoy this interview. Now, you were telling me about the WYSIWYG, and I had no idea what you were talking about when you said WYSIWYG, but it's the advanced post engine, right?
Yeah, the editor. Yep. So when you're basically, the difference is when you go to write a post, you either use the classic editor, which is the old board code, you know, square bracket engine, and then the WYSIWYG just stands for what you see is what you get, and that's the newer one. That's more like a Word or Notepad or whatever that has, you know, you click bold, you see it, the word bold. So
right.
The editing happens right in front of your eyes, and you go from there. That thing needs not a complete overhaul, but it needs pretty good update. The IE support, IE 8 support for it, needs some tweaking. Trying to think. I think some of the smileys and little fun stuff that needs to get an update. And then the key to that is the behind the scenes stuff that handles security, and translation. The big issue I think that people have with it is when you copy and paste stuff. See, I don't know how many people are using it, but you can go over to like CNN, highlight an article, drag it right into that window, and it should display close to what it looks like on the site. Obviously, there's formatting that's specific to each site, but I mean, that's one of the benefits is you can copy and paste stuff in there, and it'll take most of the formatting with it. You know, definitions from, you know, dictionary site, anything. And you find it, drag it, drop it, go. So that thing is going to get some tweaks and some fixes that it needs. I don't know. Again, stuff that's not huge, but it's needed.
No, it all adds up. It really does. Some more of the little things you mentioned, the quote nesting. So, you know, you're in a thread, and it's quote of a quote of a quote, and John quotes Bill, and Bill quotes Hank, and it's just 20 quotes. You said you're going to make some changes to that?
Yeah, that one is, I don't know what status I would put that in. I'm not really sure how best to attack that. Most of the problems come with really large nested quoting. There's two types. There's the huge thread that somebody posted, and then somebody quotes that. So now you've got this huge thread shown again, and then his comments afterwards that say, I agree. And it's ridiculous. You don't need to see that. The other problem comes from, you know, conversations where people continually quote each other, and by the time you're on page three, you've got this massive quote block that's made up of like 40 different quotes so far.
Right.
So we need to be able to address, hopefully. So I don't know if it's worth the, you know, the performance hit. We'll have to see. But I've got an idea on how to do it and minimize, you know, the pain on my side and provide flexibility. What I'd like to do is be able to provide it so each user can customize things like how many nested quotes they want to see in threads, separate the mobile site. Do you want to show any nested quotes, one nested quote, none? You know, I already said none, but to have that option, to basically have the flexibility to modify it for personal use. Again, whenever we do anything on the site, we look to improve and give you guys control over things versus dictate. We don't want to tell you what your user experience should be. We want you to say, okay, look, I like nested quotes, leave them alone, okay? And then Joe Schmo says, hey, I don't want to see all this junk. I just want to see the last quote. Okay, and then, you know, somebody else says, well, on the site, I want to see, you know, three levels of nesting. But mobile, I don't want to see anything because I'm on the phone. I don't want to see that crap.
Right.
So being able to customize your own, you know, experience is what we strive for. So that's kind of where I'd like to take that thing. I just don't know if it's worth the effort, but we'll see.
Right, and that was one of the things you mentioned that will be for the future. That's not one of the most upcoming ones that's going to
No,
happen.
That's not in the near future, just because of the complexity of the whole thing.
Right.
You know, when people ask for stuff like that, they think it might be easy. Some of this stuff is a pain. It's just, I don't even want to get into the the string of vulgarities I could put out there right now on how complicated it starts getting.
Another thing you said for the future was to people to be able to get their own individual calendar.
Yep. We've had, in the past we had a calendar, like a shared site calendar. We put stuff like the gun shows upcoming in different areas, let people post their own stuff, but nobody really used it. So if people don't care about it, we don't care about it. And that neglect is my fault completely. So what we're trying to, what we're going to do is resurrect the whole calendar thing, but make it more useful for everybody. For example, you will be able to post shared information. So if you've got a class, you want to post, you know, you're a trainer, or you guys are doing a social event in your area, we might have filters set up so you can search for, you know, your state. Since zip code isn't really required, it's, you know, I don't want to do anything like that, but state, I think, is good enough. You know, look what's going on in my state. Okay, well, here's a shoot this day, and here's a gathering, a dinner. Oh, I'd like to go and meet some ARFCON people, stuff like that. At the same time, we're going to provide personal calendaring, which is another get-out-of-jail-free card for those of us who are married and spend too much time on the site. Well, now you're going to be able to set up stuff like your anniversary or your, you know, birthdays or anything that you might forget, and then set up warnings for those, just like the IM warnings that pop up. And you can set a frequency, you know, once a day, all the time, once every 15 minutes. You'll be able to do the same with the scheduled events and control them, you know, at your level. So you'll have a little private calendar. You'll get warnings and alerts whenever you need to. You'll be able to have shared stuff, both site-wide and maybe even at group level. Just haven't figured that out if I want to go, what detail we want to get into. At least not at this point.
Right.
I think the full shared stuff, regional stuff, or state stuff, and then, you know, personal. And then give people a chance to really make something useful out of it.
No, I think it's a great idea. I love the idea. I love the analogy you made, you know, for everybody who's married, you can put your wife's, you can put your anniversary in there, put your wife's birthday in there, so you will never, ever forget it. Every time you log on ARFCOM a few days before, it'll pop up whenever you tell it to and remind you, so you do not forget and you can stay out of the doghouse. I love that.
Yeah, nobody wants to get in trouble. And I know that firsthand because I've worked through stuff and I've been like, oh, man, I missed that. And then,
oops.
Yeah, you don't want to deal with that. Nobody wants to deal with that. That's life-threatening.
Yeah, that is. It is relationship-threatening.
We'll try to help out there, too.
Yeah, see, ARFCOM, AR15.com, always good for some relationship help. You talked about team thread tracking. You were going to change a little bit for the team members to track threads.
Oh, yeah, the big one. Okay. This is something that I've wanted to do for a while. Again, it's a resource issue. We can thank the guys who signed up for the new Lifetime members. You know, we opened those up for a little bit, again, based on request, and, you know, it was talked about on, I don't even remember this, like the second show on the radio.
Yeah, we did.
On the program. So, yeah, we used all that fundage for servers. I mean, that helped float some of the bill. And with the new resources, one of the things we're going to add is a, basically, I don't even know how to call it, but just thread tracking. And by this, I mean, it's going to be for team members. You go into a thread, it's going to track when you went into that thread and what the last post was in that thread. So it's going to assume you read to the end of that, you know, up to at that point.
Right.
Now, we have to do that because if we start breaking down exactly where you left off and all that, or bookmarking in threads, it's going to be a pain in the butt. That I don't have a problem expanding into, you know, setting bookmarks in certain threads. So you have, like, basically a jump portal. But for now, it's just going to track every thread you go into and where you left off. So at any point in time, you come back to the site, you go into a thread, you'll have a little new little icon. You'll be able to click that if you were already in the thread. It goes right, bam, right to where you were the last time you left it. Again,
so you don't have to search through the entire thread to get back to your last spot.
Right, and it's, again, it enhances your experience. It doesn't change it. You'll still be able to click on the thread and go into the thread at page one. If it's got multiple pages, you can jump in whatever page you want. If you use, if you're a gold member, you can jump in at your last post in the thread, which is something that I use a lot. I figure, you know, at that point, a lot of people use it. This is just one more thing, but this is something that, you know, everybody will have access to. And it's, okay, this is jump into this thread last time I left off. So there will be no more of the folder issue where, you know, you don't know where, if you read that post or when you read it and if there's anything new to it. You'll know each one individually.
Okay. Yeah, I love that idea, actually. I get tired of having to scroll through and go back and find out where I was last. Like, wait a minute, was it here? Especially some of the longer threads, like the big 40 and 50 yep. pagers.
Yeah, and now, even, like I said, even that Costa picture thread, you know, I'm like, okay, I was on page 5, but you don't know exactly where. Well, if you've got this thing, you click the button, bam, puts you right there. You don't miss any funny pictures with the anteater up there, you know. You got
that
to see those.
Thread.
That's important stuff.
That thread is hilarious, man. I can't even believe how funny. Some of the Photoshops are just incredible. One thing you talked about I want to get to here before we go is you're going to start a new section for veterans and people that are actually serving in the military right now.
Yeah, this is something we'll probably be announcing on the site soon. We actually talked about it a year ago, and we kind of pushed it aside. Just because we had so many other things going on. The infrastructure is already there, and everything's pretty much set. And the staff is, you know, part of the thing was just getting the staff on board, getting mods to commit to it, and basically the people who are going to help run the show. And what we're going to do is we have a private section of the site that nobody knows about except for the staff, and they remind me constantly. And it's going to be for active and retired military. So a very, you know, more private area for people to be able to talk and, you know, get all kinds of support, kind of just vent, anything you need to do. And you're going to do it in a very private setting. You're going to have people around you that have been through it. You know, if you're overseas now and you're going through a tough time, well, you know, you now have the resource to talk to both other guys that are over there, as well as guys who might have been through something similar from,
right.
You know, maybe they ran into the same problems at a previous point, whether they're vets from, you know, the olden days like my old man or older. But you have that support structure there for our guys overseas who may need it, especially when they come home, you know, hooking up with guys, even over there, you know, maybe hooking up, we just want to be able to do more, provide some additional support for that. So, yeah, we'll have a sign-up policy, and you're pretty much going to have to provide credentials.
Right.
To prove that you served and where and what. And don't worry, it's already come up about, you know, is it just U.S. only or whatnot, and Stryker fought, you know, been fighting for the Canadians and everybody else. So we plan on doing a very basic form structure in there, and then probably provide kind of like a regional type thing or country type forums for
right. Guys
who want to just keep stuff private between themselves, because I don't want to start any of this, you know, us versus you or you guys
no. Screwed
up or anything like that. You know, if somebody's concerned about something, they should be able to keep it private.
Yeah, they should. And I think it's just a great idea to give some support to these veterans coming back. You know, there's just such a unique set of circumstances and unique problems that these guys face, and to be able to reach out to someone else who's been through the same thing you've been through to help you out, I can just see how that's just would be invaluable. It's going to be a really good addition.
Especially in a private setting where there's no, you know, there's no risk of, or at least little risk of either embarrassing yourself or,
right.
You know, feeling like people are, the wrong people are going to read things.
Right.
It's a very private thing. It's going to help hopefully have people make connections. It's always one of the best things about the site was the connections that you made. You know, people are like-minded. You might not get along with them all, but you know, you learn that even some of the people that you hate reading their stuff and you argue with on the site, you meet them somewhere, and the next thing you know is, you know, you're friends with the guy and everything changes. So I think the relationships are key to why the site is so special, the community is so special. We just want to give another outlet for that, for those guys. And, you know, the forums are still there. Obviously, every section of the site is open, but it's just a little bit more private.
Yeah, and I've met some really cool people already just in the short time I've been on the site. So I've met some really good friends, and I'm excited to meet some of them in real life. You too, if you can ever take some time off working. People, you guys don't know, this guy works sometimes till 3-4 in the morning, settling disputes and writing code and just problem after problem. Anytime there's a problem, it gets forwarded to him, and he's got to fix it. So he's a very important cog in the ARFCOM machine, and he'll try to downplay it, and, you know, everybody's, we're a team and everything, but this guy does a lot of work for the site, you guys.
Oh, no, it's not a problem, but keep in mind, and I'm downplaying it here, you guys got, everybody's got to appreciate the work that the mods and the staff do. I mean, everybody, it takes all of us to make the site special. Every single person that's on the site is there for a reason, and that, again, is what makes it unique, is that you can have an argument with a guy and go have a beer with him, you know, the next day, and you still know you've got stuff in common, and there's enough ground there to get over anything. And the mods and the staff really, you know, bust their butts for no other reason than because they love the site and they love the community. And that's what's important. And those guys deserve a lot of praise. So,
I couldn't have said it any better myself, actually.
I apologize for this being taped, but Mondays are horrible for me. This time of year, just family stuff come up. So I will try to make myself available for one night where we can do this live and take questions and threats and stuff live, because it'll be more fun that way.
Oh, yeah, that'll be fun. Thanks, Juan.
All right, you got it.
That was the infamous Goat Boy talking a little bit about some of the work he does behind the scenes to keep AR15.com rolling. Right now we move along in our show, and I'm really excited about this next segment. I've been wanting to do a show on EMP for a long time. And our good friend Joe DeBurgolis put me in touch, through David, Bellavia, put me in touch with Impact America. They're an organization started by Mr. Henry Schwartz, and we've got him on. And we've also got the president of Impact America. It's spelled EMP Act America. His name is Dr. Vincent Pry. How are you gentlemen doing this afternoon? This evening, actually, where you're at.
Great. Thank you for having us
great
on.
It's great to have you guys on.
Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. Like I said, I've been wanting to do a show on EMP for a long time. Before I was put in touch with your website, actually, first, it's www.empactamerica.net. So for all our listeners, go check out the website now while we've got these guys online. If you guys want to call up and ask any questions to either of them, feel free. The lines are open. If you want to just IM me a question, I'll be checking my IMs throughout this interview, and I'll ask those questions through the IMs if you've got them. Why don't we start out with you, Mr. Schwartz? I know you're a man that wears several different hats. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about how you went from being a successful farmer to a successful businessman to a person that got involved in EMP and the cause of getting our infrastructure shielded against EMP?
Well, our family haven't been in farming for a while, but we have been in the dairy business and in the food business. And I was in the Air Force back in the 50s, and I was in a unit that had nuclear-tipped missiles stationed in Germany. So I guess that was part of the background. When I learned about EMP, I sought out an expert, and I found Dr. Pry. And he had worked for the EMP Commission, and he had a background in nuclear affairs, national defense, CIA. And he brought me up to speed, and it was clear that what we needed to do was to make all of America aware of what was happening. Because, as you'll learn, all of us, all of our families, our employees, people in our community, and, of course, the rest of America are threatened, really threatened by what can happen to us imminently. And we decided to move forward, and perhaps you want to ask your next question, or I can go on.
No, I'll ask a question here. So you formed Impact America, and I'm looking at your board of advisors, and it is an impressive group of people. You've got congressmen. You've got Dr. William Forsten, who everybody knows wrote the book One Second After, the book that really opened America's eyes to the threat of EMP. You've got retired admirals. It's just... You got scientists. It's just amazing some of the people you were able to put together. All these people are very concerned about the threat of EMP, which is a very real threat. And we'll get into the specifics of the threat later. But you assembled these great minds together, and you were actually you put together a conference last fall. Is that correct?
Yes, but I think Dr. Pry was the main one that did that, so perhaps he could talk about it.
Oh, okay. Dr. Pry, go ahead.
Yes. I think just the fact that that conference happened and the purpose of the conference was to send a signal to America about this imminent threat and how serious it was. The people we had speaking at that conference, you know, were former EMP commissioners, former director of the CIA, former director of the Defense Nuclear Agency, this country's senior most scientists, like Bill Radaski, who holds the Lord Kelvin Medal on electromagnetic physics. Normally these people only speak about these matters in classified forums in the halls of Congress to the White House. I think this was probably the first time we had such a prestigious group of people going to a private event, a privately sponsored event, to speak out publicly in front of the media about EMP and about the imminent threat that it poses for our country and about the necessity urgently to do something about it. And I believe that the conference was a landmark event because of that reason. And it did help tremendously, drew a lot of attention, a lot more attention to the problem than we've had, but we're still lagging far behind in terms of actually doing anything. You know, the country is actually still not doing anything to act on the EMP Commission's plan to actually put it into operation. We're taking legal steps. We're putting in place the bureaucratic procedures which are necessary before you can act, but the process is moving very, very slowly, more slowly than the threat, I'm afraid. We're basically in a race with Iran before they get a nuclear weapon, because Iran has written and practiced, conducting EMP attacks and has written specifically about attacking the United States, and we're a race with Mother Nature, because EMP is not just the threat that could be posed by terrorists or states, but it can also come naturally, and by means of a great geomagnetic storm. We've not had a great geomagnetic storm during the electronic age, but many scientists think we're overdue for one.
Yeah, that's what makes this threat particularly unnerving, is the fact that it's almost inevitable that it will happen, whether it's man-made or whether Mother Nature does it to us. And there's no amount of sanctions or negotiation you can do with the sun to keep it from releasing some of those solar waves. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how EMP works, just exactly what EMP is, how it works, the specific nature of the threat.
Okay. Basically, an electromagnetic pulse is a super energetic radio wave that can fry electronics. It's got so much energy in it, it passes harmlessly through people's bodies, but will fry electronics over vast regions of the Earth's surface, over the entire continental United States, if the nuclear weapon is detonated at the correct altitude, a couple hundred kilometers, over the entire northern hemisphere of the planet, if you're talking about a great geomagnetic storm. And all of our critical national infrastructures, the electric power grid, transportation systems, systems to provide food, water, that keep fuel flowing, emergency services, all of the things that make us a modern civilization, a functioning modern civilization, depend directly or indirectly on electronics. And when the electronics are destroyed, we cease to be a modern civilization. It's basically a high-tech means, if you're talking about a weapon. It's a high-tech means of killing people the old-fashioned way, starvation, disease, societal breakdown, and anarchy. And the EMP Commission estimated, for example, that given our present state of unpreparedness, 12 months after an EMP event, we are expected to lose two-thirds of our national population, 200 million people, because we won't be able to feed them or provide water for them. You know, the way, reason we can sustain such a large population, which is three times, more than three times the size that our population was during the 19th century when we were basically an agrarian people, you know, is because of the high technologies that we have. But let me get a little bit more into the physics of the EMP, which I think is the question you were really asking about. How does this EMP happen? It's really, let me try to put it in simple terms, and because it is basically a simple phenomenon. It's on a larger scale, it's the same principle that your lawnmower magneto operates on. When you want to start your lawnmower, you know, you pull out a cord, and that spins magnets, which cause a magnetic wave to move past the coil in your lawnmower. And a moving magnetic wave will generate an electric current in wires. That's basically the principle that all EMP operates on. A moving magnetic wave generates an electric current in wires. The one way that this happens with both geomagnetic storms and nuclear weapons, when you set up a nuclear weapon in space, high above the atmosphere, the expanding fireball causes the magnetosphere that surrounds us, the lines of geomagnetic force that are natural. You know, the Earth has a north and south pole, and there's this natural magnetic field that surrounds the whole Earth. Anyway, the nuclear fireball distorts that magnetic field. It causes the long lines of magnetic force to vibrate and wave back and forth as the fireball expands and then collapses. And so you get a great magnetic field in motion up high above the atmosphere that induces currents on all the electric wires that are down on the surface of the Earth, particularly on power lines, communications lines, but on all wires that are of sufficient length so that the electromagnetic pulse can connect with them. And that's what causes things to fry out. Another form of EMP, one that is, and the geomagnetic storm does it that same way. The solar flare strikes the magnetosphere, causes the magnetosphere to vibrate, wave back and forth, and induce these magnetic fields. Same principle that makes your lawnmower start, except on a huge planetary scale. Another form of EMP, another way EMP is created, it's called E1. This is the peculiar to nuclear weapons. Nature doesn't do this. Only nuclear weapons generate this kind of EMP. And it's the E1 is the electromagnetic shock wave. And it propagates at the speed of light, and it's got tremendous amounts of energy in it. And this thing can very promptly fry out electronics. The other kind of EMP that I was describing earlier, E3, or magnetohydrodynamic EMP is its technical name, you know, propagates more slowly, but it's got a lot of energy in it. And the damage mechanism is different for that kind. The shock wave hits things at the speed of light, and part of the reason it's peculiarly damaging is that it's moving so fast with all of that energy that it moves faster than most surge arresters can react. So most of the defensive mechanisms, in fact, the defensive mechanisms which commonly work against lightning will not work against the E1 EMP because it comes on too fast. It also has far too much energy. It's far more powerful than the lightning stroke.
Right.
Now, how is this caused? What causes the E1 that's peculiar to nuclear weapons? Well, this is caused by gamma radiation. The nuclear weapons, all nuclear weapons. It doesn't have to be a nuclear weapon of special design, although there are such weapons specifically designed to make EMP. But any nuclear weapon, even a tactical nuclear artillery shell or crude first-generation nuclear weapon, they all generate gamma rays. And when you detonate a nuclear weapon at high altitude, the gamma rays come out, and they will strike electrons off of atoms high in the atmosphere. These electrons, moving at the speed of light, will spiral around the lines of geomagnetic force. Instead of causing the lines of geomagnetic force to move, the electrons are moving. They're moving at the speed of light. They're moving in very, very short circles. And again, you have this principle of a magnetic field that's in motion, except this magnetic field, you know, is not the big, slow-moving magnetic field of the planetary magnetosphere moving, but it's this very fast, very energetic spiraling of the electrons. There's a scientific name for this. It's called the Compton effect, Compton electron effect.
Okay.
And this is what generates this super energetic E1 radio wave. I sometimes use the analogy of thinking of EMP as like a tidal wave. You know, a tidal wave, if you look at it from the side and profile, has got an almost flat front. And that flat front has tremendous energy in it, enough to knock down buildings and trees and everything. and it's the shockwave part of the tidal wave. That's the E1 EMP. And then the tidal wave is followed by a long surge of water that has potentially even more energy in it, but it comes on slowly and it causes flooding and it moves the damaged stuff around and will cause a lot of deaths from flooding and the like. That's the E3,
right.
The MHD EMP. So you get this 1-2 punch from nuclear EMP that is particularly devastating. If the E1 doesn't get you, the E3 will. Sorry if that was a rather long explanation.
I thought it was great, Peter.
Yeah, I thought it was outstanding, especially for someone that, you know, hasn't really studied it as much as I should have, especially now that I know the threat. It's really interesting to notice it. Think of it as a tidal wave. You get hit, the nuclear bomb goes off up in the atmosphere, you get hit really hard immediately by the front of that wave, the E1, and then whatever circuits are still alive after that have to deal with the E3, the long, drawn-out flooding of just continual power for a while. Now, I spoke with you earlier today.
Exactly. So you get that first shock wave that can cause stuff to fail and fail at the speed of light. And then if that wasn't enough, you get this long, slow burn on the wires as the E3 comes through.
Yeah, it's amazing the way that works. Now, I spoke with you earlier today, and I told you how impressed I was with your bio. I read your bio on Impact America, and you've been involved with EMP in one way or another now for the better part of 3 decades, 25 years. Why is the threat just now becoming something that people are becoming aware of? It seems to me like, you know, when we were in the nuclear age and starting back in the 40s, and we realized that EMP was a factor, that we would have gone out of our way as a government to shield, you know, our major critical things. But here we are, you know, 6 decades after that, and we still are vulnerable to this threat.
Yes, you're quite right, and it's quite depressing to be reminded that I've been working on this for so long, and the country is still vulnerable. That feels like failure to me. And it's also very depressing to see, you know, as you're quite right, that we haven't taken steps to protect the critical national infrastructures despite knowing about this phenomenology for so long. And that, too, is failure, not just personal failure, but, you know, failure at the national level. Well, first of all,
Peter, forgive me for interrupting, but I don't think we were aware of this until the mid-60s with the Starfish test. So the initial, but go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth, Henry.
All right, go ahead.
That's where I was going to start, with the Starfish 1962 event. We didn't even know about EMP. We didn't know about it immediately in 1945. It wasn't really discovered, the high-altitude EMP, until, and we didn't conduct tests looking for EMP. It surprised us. Knocked the lights out in Hawaii, and we didn't know how that happened or what it did. That's where someone who is even more of an expert than I am, Dr. William Graham, came on the scene. His first job as a U.S. Army scientist was to investigate this EMP phenomenology. Dr. Graham ended up being the chairman of our EMP commission. So it was discovered in 1962. The Soviets actually knew about it earlier because they, unlike us, they were conducting their nuclear tests, their high-altitude nuclear tests, closer to major cities and over the ground. And so they learned about EMP sooner and had more data than us. Now, when I say we knew about it, the we I'm referring to are the defense scientists, nuclear strategists, and the cognoscenti within the nuclear community. They knew about it from 1962 onward. Some information leaked out into the public. There was a chapter on EMP in a book, a Department of Defense Atomic Energy Commission book called The Effects of Nuclear Weapons that was published. It was maybe a 10-page long description. But most people, including responsible policymakers and even academics and most people working the nuclear issue, weren't aware of EMP, or it was not high in their consciousness. It was only in a small, specialized community who followed this. And so where the broad public was concerned, when they thought about nuclear threats, you know, they thought about the blast and the thermal effects, but EMP was not on their minds. And we are a democracy. People do need to be informed. And that's one of the reasons, the fact that people were in the dark about it for so long, Another reason, though, was that all through the Cold War, the way EMP was going to be used, it was going to be, the threat was going to be the leading edge of a massed Soviet nuclear attack on the United States. And we actually now, we know that is true, that that's how the Soviets planned their first strike, that they would lead with a large EMP attack, the object of which would be to paralyze our strategic command and control and paralyze our strategic nuclear forces so that they wouldn't be able to launch, stop presidential emergency action messages from getting out to our forces so they couldn't execute. And that would hold them up long enough so that Soviet ICBMs and sub-launch ballistic missiles could reach their targets and destroy them with blast, destroy the bombers on the ground, destroy the ICBMs in their silos, destroy the third of submarines that would be in the port. And by that EMP precursor attack, as it was called, the Soviets hoped they could win a nuclear war. From the U.S. perspective, it seemed an exercise in futility to try to harden and protect our critical civilian infrastructures, the electric power grid, the telecommunication systems, and the like, from EMP, because it was in the context of a scenario where there are going to be thousands of nuclear detonations on the body of the United States. So even if you spent, you know, large amounts of money trying to protect against EMP, you'd still end up losing those critical national infrastructures to the massive blast effects. Furthermore, it wasn't considered practical. The threat from EMP, the phenomenology, is so damaging that people looking at it in the Cold War felt that it would just be too expensive and too difficult to protect the nation, you know, against EMP, even if they did somehow manage to survive the blast effects. As the Cold War went on toward the end of the Cold War, the Soviets developed what they call super EMP weapons. And these are weapons specially designed to generate extraordinarily powerful EMP effects. EMP effects that are more powerful than the hardening systems that exist within our strategic nuclear forces and strategic command and control. You know, so basically, these weapons were designed so that with a single nuclear weapon, a single super EMP weapon, they could use one weapon, in their view, to win a nuclear war by paralyzing and destroying with the super EMP our strategic nuclear forces. Now, fortunately, the Cold War ended before that became meaningful, and the Soviet Union disintegrated. But Russia retains this technology and has continued to develop it. China claims to have super EMP weapons. And Russian scientists and South Korean intelligence have credibly claimed that the design information, because unfortunately it's not hard to build a super EMP weapon as it turns out, that the North Korean nuclear weapon might actually be a super EMP weapon, which is particularly alarming because when the North Koreans get any kind of a technology, it's not long before they sell it.
They sell it, and then it goes to all these rogue states?
The EMP threat. Excuse me?
The North Koreans sell it, and that's the threat of it going to some of these rogue states.
Yes, exactly. For example, the Iranian Shahab-3, their medium-range ballistic missile, which is right now the premier weapon in their missile fleet, is actually based on the North Korean Nodong. You know, the North Koreans have sold, and the same thing with the Pakistani Ghori, their medium-range ballistic missile is also based on the North Korean Nodong. And there have been reports that the Iranians have been trying to buy the Taipodong 1 and Taipodong 2 ICBMs, even though those haven't been successfully tested yet. And that might be the basis of the space launch vehicle that where Iran successfully orbited a satellite last April. Now the Shahab 3, the Nodongs that the Iranians got from North Korea are improved versions because the Iranians hired Russian scientists and North Korean scientists to work with them to make improvements. So the Shahab 3 is a souped up version of the Nodong, as is the Ghori. But basically, you know, if it were not for North Korea, Iran and Pakistan would not yet have medium-range ballistic missiles. You know, if they were left on their own to develop these, you know, the North Koreans broke the missile technology control regime, you know, to sell these missiles. So North Korea is notorious for breaking arms control agreements and proliferating destabilizing technologies. and long-range ballistic missile technology is every bit as threatening and destabilizing as nuclear weapons technology. And the fear is, if, since North Korea has a history of selling anything to anybody, you know, when they get nuclear weapons, you know, they, as they have that now, you know, they are currently a nuclear weapons state, you know, they may well end up selling these to future actors. And it will be particularly bad for civilization if it is a super EMP weapon that is currently in the possession of North Korea.
Now, go on.
I actually didn't finish answering your question about when did EMP finally come to light. To wrap up quickly, it wasn't really until congressional hearings in 1995. I ran those hearings where we had the first congressional hearings where we started talking openly about EMP because a judgment was made that the people needed to know. You know, we're a democracy. We need to inform the people about the existence of this threat that had been basically undercover for so long and not widely understood or appreciated. Those hearings didn't really get that much coverage, so the word still didn't get out at the time. Then in 2008, the EMP Commission delivered its report to Congress, unclassified, and did so in front of open hearings. So there was another effort to educate the people and get the word out. But still, we didn't receive that much attention. There wasn't that much coverage. We are a democracy. There does seem to be a correlation between the amount of attention that's paid to a threat and the amount of action that you actually get from policymakers, passing laws, appropriating money, doing the right things to protect the people. And when Henry Schwartz came along and started Impact America, and he does great credit to me that I don't deserve by representing me as sort of co-founding Impact America, Henry did that all on his own and came to me afterwards to ask me to help. And, you know, he and his fellows in upstate New York deserve enormous credit for taking the initiative. It gives a person faith that democracy may indeed work after all. You know, that there is more wisdom out there among the common people than there are in the halls of Congress and the Pentagon even. You know, that they see a threat, they see that nothing's being done, and they want to take action. And Henry's group, Impact America, you know, has actually made more progress over the past year in getting things done and moving the issue forward, I'm sorry to say, than the EMP Commission did in the 8 years of its existence. And it's because of the publicity, and because of shows like this, where we've managed to get the word out to the American people and draw them to our flag, draw them to our colors, get them to write their congressmen, get them to talk to their neighbors, get them to take personal actions, you know, to protect themselves, not just against EMP, but other threats as well. Anyway, I apologize again if I've gone on at too great length. But
no,
that's
fine.
Lack of knowledge of EMP, why this threat hadn't been heard of. I would add this, the knowledge about a great geomagnetic storm. The EMP Commission and its investigations discovered that. In 2008, that was an entirely new threat. That came on the scene as a result of the EMP Commission's investigations. So, you know, here's a threat that people hadn't even been aware of that is, in effect, newly discovered.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question. We are overdue, actually, for one of these big solar storms. The last one was back in the 1800s, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
That's right. It's called the Carrington Event in 1859. They didn't understand what was happening. They didn't understand the phenomenology in 1859. All they knew that there was an aurora borealis over London that was so bright you could read the newspapers by it. And the early primitive electronic systems of the day, like the transatlantic cable, had just been laid. And it was burned out. The EMP was so intense it reached down under to the depths of the Atlantic Ocean and burned out the first transatlantic cable, which had to be relayed. It caused widespread fires and telegraph stations and things like that. However, at the time, you know, the world was still an agrarian place. Electronics were a novelty, and they weren't crucial to the survival of society. So the last great geomagnetic storm, you know, 1859, happened just at the very beginning of the electronic age. Now, we can go back in the historical records. People have, although they, in the past, in the distant past, they didn't understand solar storms and and great geomagnetic storms. They didn't understand the phenomenology, but, you know, they did notice when the aurora borealis, this peculiar meteorological event, would show up on the equator, for example, or in the distant south, where it's almost never seen. And people would record that in their diaries and the like. And going back and looking for evidence of that, you know, we've been able to establish that under that phenomenology, the appearance of an aurora borealis so far south is the signature of a great geomagnetic storm. Normally, great geomagnetic storms happen on an annual basis, but they're usually normal geomagnetic storms that are limited to nations in the high northern latitudes, Canada, the Nordic countries, that sort of thing. When it propagates that far south, it's a great geomagnetic storm, much more powerful. EMP fields, much more intense. Anyway, if you go back over the historical records, every century or two, you know, you get a great geomagnetic storm. Many scientists think that we're overdue for one, because the last time, you know, this is pretty consistent in the historical record. Every century or so one happens. You know, the last time was 1859, so we're more than a century overdue for one of these things. And some scientists think associate this with the year 2012, because that's the year of that NASA says, well, it's not just NASA, but it is just a fact that is the decade or 11-year peak solar cycle. It happens every decade or every 11 years with the sun.
But of course, it could happen tomorrow.
It could happen
or
tomorrow.
Or any other time. So it isn't 2012. No one knows.
No one knows.
Right.
No one knows. But there is a school of thought that, you know, since it's like a roulette wheel, that the more solar storms you get, the more likely you are to get one. And that's why there is a concern about 2012. I'm reluctant to mention that because there's so much hoodoo out there based on mythology, you know, the Mayan mythology and the Nostradamus predictions and things like that. There are a lot of absurd books that have been written based on non-scientific issues about 2012. But it is a fact that, you know, that we are due for the next peak solar cycle in 2012, and that there are some scientists who credibly think that could be a time of particular concern for a great geomagnetic storm because of the increased solar activity.
Now, while a nuclear weapon would most likely, I mean, we're the obvious target for a nuclear weapon. We're the big dog on the block. We're the most hated. We're not going to go use an EMP weapon on somebody else or a nuclear weapon on someone else unless it's in retaliation of a nuclear weapon. But when you're talking about an EMP weapon, that would affect the United States. But with these solar storms, that would basically affect the whole globe, putting the whole globe back into just total chaos?
Well, it could, you know, depending on the intensity of the solar of the great geomagnetic storm.
Right.
Some great geomagnetic storms are of a size that it could be limited to the continental United States. Others are of such a scale that you're talking about the entire northern hemisphere, which is where most of the nations of the world are located. If you look at a globe, most of the land masses are above the equator.
Okay. We're on with Henry Schwartz and Dr. Peter Vincent Pry from Impact America. Their website is EMPACT, impactamerica.net. I want everyone to check it out.
.org.
Oh, is it .org? I'm on .net org. Right now looking at it. You're also on .org as well?
Yes.
Okay, looks like you have both domains secured. Okay. I encourage everyone to go check out their website. It's very eye-opening stuff. It's not tinfoil hat brigade stuff, ladies and gentlemen. This is a legitimate threat to our way of life, to our families, to our children, our communities. It is very serious. Now, let's talk about some of the feasibility of this. You know, there's a lot of talk about you need lots of scientists, you need lots of support people to actually, you know, let me back up a little bit. I feel Iran already has nukes. I think Iran, I think they've got nuclear weapons. They've been refining nuclear material for a long time. I think it's foolish for anyone to think that they're 5 years away from a nuclear weapon is just foolish. I think they've already got them. Now, is it feasible, is it tactically and logistically feasible for them to weaponize it? They've already got it weaponized, in my opinion, to put it on a boat and just sail it out off the coast and fire it off above America? Is it really that simple?
Yes, it is really that simple. EMP also has the virtue of being an operationally simple military tactic to execute. You know, you just need a single missile. It doesn't have to be accurate. It could be a Scud missile, or the Iranian Shahab-3 would be ideal. They have actually practiced launching Shahab-3s to high altitude and detonating them with not using a nuclear weapon, of course, because, you know, they at least publicly have not displayed possession of a nuclear weapon yet. They have practiced launching missiles off of a ship in the Caspian. The only reason they would do that to try to acquire launch mode to launch a missile off a ship is to attack some country not in the Middle East. This is because the Shahab-3 has enough range from Iran to reach any enemy they might have in the Middle East, particularly Israel. So you'd only practice ship launching if you wanted to attack some country not in the Middle East. They write about attacking the United States with EMP. You know, you could take a ship, sail it outside of the U.S. territorial waters, and launch it, you know, to the proper altitude, and potentially cover, you know, the east coast of the United States, or if you went to, angled it inland and went to the right altitude, you could do it with a Shahab-3. You could cover the whole continental United States with an EMP. The area of effect is so great that you basically can't miss, even though ship launching of a ballistic missile is an inaccurate process. The accuracy doesn't matter when you're dealing with EMP. And you can carry large numbers of technicians and scientists on a ship so that you can baby the missile and the warhead and ensure that everything is functional, is going to operate. The Shahab-3 is a very reliable missile, by the way, and, you know, has a very high success rate, just as does the North Korean NODAW, unlike their ICBM, which is constantly failing because they haven't perfected it yet. And nuclear weapons are, also have a good track record. There's no evidence that any nation has ever had a failed test, of a nuclear weapon when it's made its first go at it. You know, even the United States, the first time nuclear weapons, we had two atomic weapons of completely different design, and both of them worked perfectly. One of them we didn't even bother testing, you know, the Hiroshima bomb.
Wow, that's scary stuff. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, I saw on the military channel, I believe it was the military channel last year, they did a show about EMP and its effect on vehicles. And they ran a car through this EMP generator, and it shut the car down, but it didn't destroy the circuitry. A few minutes later, you were able to start the car back up. Is the effect on automobiles the same as the effect on, like, our grids and our infrastructure, where our grids would be completely fried? Would our automobiles be fried as well?
Well, that depends upon the kind of weapon, all right, and the location of the vehicle when it happens. Now, if you're talking about a super EMP weapon, yes, that is likely to fry automobiles, and you wouldn't be able to restart it. You know, unless the automobile is in an underground shelter, for example, you know, if it's a parking garage or something like that, something that protects it from the EMP wave. However, if you're talking about a crude first-generation nuclear weapon or a tactical nuclear weapon that was purchased from the Russians, or a fairly low-yield weapon. These weapons, while they generate E1, which is the wave that would couple into an automobile and cause damage to a small target like that, you know, their E1 fields aren't that powerful, and they're more than powerful enough to take out electric power grids and telecommunication systems, you know, because, well, we refer to the power of these things in volts per meter. You know, the reason for that is to figure out the power of a nuclear weapon, its EMP power, you take a look at the volts it creates and multiply that by the length of the meter of the target. You know, so if you've got, let's say, a crude first-generation weapon that might produce in its E1, let's say 1,000 volts per meter, all right? That means for every meter of length of the target, you're getting 1,000 volts.
Okay.
So if you think of a power line which runs for kilometers, you know, you're talking about many thousands of meters. And so you multiply that by 1,000 volts, and you're talking about millions of meters going over that line, millions of volts, excuse me, going
right
over that line. Now, an automobile isn't very long, you know, I mean, you know, what, 20 feet at most, 15 feet, so you multiply 15 by 1,000, and that's how much energy is surging through the automobile. Still, 15,000 volts, that's a lot of voltage. But most automobiles have, you know, metal bodies, and that can serve as some kind of a protection, sort of a Faraday cage. And the EMP Commission estimated that if you're talking about, you know, low-yield nuclear weapons, these are not likely to knock out an automobile. Maybe something like 1 to 2% of automobiles, you know, might be affected, might be knocked out by the low-yield EMP. However, we know from modeling, and if anybody has even just lived in a big city, that if you had 1% of automobiles suddenly fail out there on the highways, that would be catastrophic and end up tying up transportation. From the lesser EMP threat, the lower type EMP threat, the thing that's going to stop automobiles is the gas stations aren't going to work, because gas stations require electricity to pump gasoline.
Right.
And your car would only be useful as long as you had gasoline to put into the tank. And that ain't going to be very long. As soon as you've used up your gas, you won't be able to get any more from the gas station. So unless the grid could be brought back in a big hurry, you know, even if large numbers of automobiles do survive the EMP, you know, they're all going to run out of gas and be useless.
John, in the few minutes we have left, perhaps you should ask Peter about what we can do. You'll be amazed that it's not that complicated nor that expensive in order to protect the nation.
Right. You read my mind, actually. That was going to be my next question. We know how deadly and how serious this threat is, and that it is inevitable, either through Mother Nature or through the hands of man, that there's going to be an attack. Let's talk about what we can do as a country and what people can do individually to shield our systems against EMP. Like Mr. Schwartz was saying, I understand it's a relatively easy and low-tech thing to do.
Well, yes. At the national level, the most important thing would be to protect the national electric power grid, because all of the critical infrastructures depend upon it. And the heart of the electric power grid is our big transformers. The commission found there are several hundred big transformers. They're absolutely indispensable to the running of the national electric grid. And you can protect these things, by example, by either putting them in a Faraday cage, you know, which is basically a big metal shed. You could put, there is a new surge arrestor that looks very promising that could be put onto these things. One could buy spare transformers and have them off the grid, protected in a metal shed, and bring them online. You know, so there are several ways of protecting them. There are, you can ground them in special ways to protect them against the effects of a great geomagnetic storm. You know, there are some estimates that for as little as $100 million, you know, we could mitigate the worst effects of an EMP attack on our society by protecting the big transformers that are necessary to recovering the electric grid. And so that could be the difference between losing 200 million American lives and losing our civilization and being able to recover our civilization, just $100 million. Now, once that, I want to be to point out that is the minimum kind of an investment to protect the grid and to protect society, because even if you just protect those transformers, it's still going to be a long, slow process to bring back the whole electric grid and then bring back the other critical infrastructures. That at least gives you a fighting chance to save your society and recover your society and avoid those mass deaths. It doesn't guarantee it. You know, linked with that, you need to have a plan, you know, but at least that kind of an investment gets you past the line where it's not inevitable that you're going to end up having your civilization be snuffed out by EMP. You know, we should do at least that much. We probably should do much more than that. You know, there are much more ambitious things we can do. You know, there are these systems called SCADAs, System Control and Data Acquisition System, that exist everywhere in all the critical infrastructures. And they're basically little computers that regulate functions in the transportation system, in the electric grid, water, power, fuel systems. These things are extremely vulnerable to EMP, and yet you can design SCADAs, redesign them, and then as they get slowly, as we replace them in the normal cycles of maintenance, you know, we could replace these old SCADAs with newer SCADAs which are hardened against EMP effects. And this would be another huge step forward to protect us and to help recover the critical infrastructures. Oh, there's... And the third most important thing is planning, planning at the federal, state, local level, and planning in our individual lives. And I should say, add that the plan that the EMP Commission came up with, that it recommends that the federal government follow, and that states should follow, you know, these plans, and that individuals should follow, you know, are not exclusive to EMP. We're not just talking about protecting society only against EMP. These protections would also work against cyber threats, against sabotage, against natural disasters like hurricanes. For example, on the personal level, probably the most important thing you could do to protect yourself against EMP is make sure you've got food and water to support your family for a protracted period of time, at least weeks, preferably months. Do what your grandparents used to do and take personal responsibility for protecting that family. Have a medical kit. Available. You know, a plan, a personal plan for your family about what you're going to do. If you've got land, you might want to start a little garden or something. You know, this sort of thing that would be useful to you, not just in an EMP event, but in a cyber event that shuts down the infrastructures, or during a natural disaster like a hurricane or something that basically knocks out the critical infrastructures for a long time or isolates people, so they're basically on their own. The less system-dependent individuals become, the more rugged individualism we get back, the easier it will be to recover the rest of society. I would say those who have the ability to be rugged individualists and to take care of themselves, to have these backup plans, actually have an ethical obligation to do so, because it will enable the system to use more resources to help the truly helpless, that need that support.
Right. Really,
I'm afraid I've been dominating this conversation. I think you should hear.
You're doing just great, Peter.
Henry Schwartz is a great man, and you should, Henry, perhaps you should. I'm sorry, I don't want to take over the interview, but
thank you, Peter. But I think John may have come to the end of our time. I don't want to call it early, John. Is that correct, or where are we at?
We've got just a couple more minutes left, but I did want to ask you guys, first of all, what can people do as far as to get involved with Impact America, and what do you guys have coming up on your schedule as far as, are there more Senate hearings coming up? We've got a House bill coming to a vote. What do we have coming up from that end?
Well, Henry, why don't you take it on Impact
America? Well, you know, Peter, you're doing so well, and you're right there in Washington, and so I think you ought to tell them what's happened. And what we hope will happen.
Well, all right. One of the there has been a landmark piece of legislation that we're hoping that will get all the way through the Congress. It's called the GRID Act, and this is finally Congress has. It's not like nobody in the government is doing anything. Congress is very concerned about EMP. It's one of the few issues, despite the extreme partisanship down in Washington right now. This is one of the few issues where you have bipartisan support for doing something about the threat. And, the GRID Act is a piece of legislation that has passed out of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and it basically will legally empower the government to work with the electric utilities to take the necessary steps to protect the utilities, to protect the national electric grid specifically. Now, I don't want to make too much of it. This doesn't mean that once this bill passes that the electric grid is, in fact, protected. What it does is it creates the legal possibility for doing that. You know, there were difficulties in the law about the federal government, how much power should it have to regulate these industries. Could it impose or require them, for example, to take the steps necessary on a national security basis to protect those transformers? Industry will likes this bill, because it also puts the responsibility on the federal government. Ratepayers won't have to pay for it. you know, the Department of Energy already has an $11 billion budgeted to helping modernize the grid. So, you know, the federal resources will be made available, you know, to help protect the national electric grid. But we're still a long way from actual actions being taken. Nonetheless, this is a very hopeful sign. It's a necessary thing to take the next step, which is actual protection of the grid. However, the Grid Act is not passed yet. It's through the House, but it still has to be voted on by the Senate, and it also has to be supported by the President. Another piece of legislation is coming out of the House Committee on Homeland Security. This is their Science and Technology Authorization Bill. And attached to this bill is a provision that would basically establish a commission. Well, we had hoped it would reestablish the EMP commission. It doesn't do that, but it does establish an electronic commission that will basically try to protect the critical infrastructures from EMP and cyber threats and all hazards. And this commission can draw upon the expertise of the EMP commission. There's specific language in there to allow it to do that, so that the 8 years of expertise on the EMP commission, the EMP commissioners can be brought back, you know, to work with this commission to implement the EMP commission's plan. That's even more important than the Grid Act, to have an actual congressional commission in existence to spearhead the effort to get our electric grid and other critical infrastructures protected. You know, without an actual commission fighting the fight down there in Washington, nothing is probably going to happen. You know, that's the way things work in Washington.
And may I add something to it? We've just completed a DVD set which shows all about what happened in Niagara Falls with our conference and explains about everything about EMP, including the EMP commission's work. And if you're listeners will go to impactamerica.org. They'll find out how they can get that set. And we'll even have individual DVDs that'll summarize it that we could send out. So I'd urge them to do so, to educate themselves and to do what we're doing. They can start their own organizations or groups. They can affiliate with us or not affiliate with us as they choose.
I'm a little bit over, but I wanted to ask you really quick, Mr. Schwartz, do you guys have another conference planned for this year?
No, we don't. We expect to do many other things, which we are, and I think that you'll be hearing a lot more from us, and if you want to have us back on, John, we'll continue this conversation. I thought Dr. Pry did an unbelievable job, and there is a lot to learn.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It is definitely my pleasure, and I would love to have you guys back on because there's so many more questions I have about EMP, and I know our listeners have questions as well. We're totally out of time today. This was Mr. Henry Schwartz and Dr. Peter Vincent Pry of Impact America. It's EMP Act America, all one word, impactamerica.org. Check out the website, everyone. It's just a really cool website. It's amazing that it took civilian people, businessmen, business leaders, and community leaders to actually get the ball rolling on this to get some legislation passed. But I'm very excited with the direction you guys are headed, and thank you for taking time to come on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's the end of the show today, everyone. I'm over. Seth is banging me on the head telling me we got to go. I want to thank Joe DeBurgolis, Neil Puckett, Goat Boy for the pre-recorded interview, Henry Schwartz, of course, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. I want to thank Merrill as well. I know he had some computer problems today, who updates our threads online. I want to thank Seth, the super producer as always, the Avila family at AR15.com, home of the Black Rifle. This has been Radio Free ARFCOM, and I want to say God bless the great Republic of the United States of America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.